Professor Abu Rabi and I have been thinking a good deal about how to do a number of things over the next few years which help all of us think about and wrestle with the gifts of Islam and the struggles in Muslim and Christian communities around modern culture. We're particularly pleased that Dr. Mumtaz Ahmed has come to open up the beginnings of this work together. He is professor of political science at Hampton University in Virginia and the executive director of the Iqbal International Institute for Research and Dialogue at the International Islamic University in Islamabad. Islamabad is on the front pages of the paper today, and I'm so happy that we see its gift with us here in the midst of the struggles that are taking place there. I first encountered his work in the extraordinary five-volume study of fundamentalism that was edited by Mark Marty, and that Dr. Ahmed was a key planner with Martin Marty in developing that extraordinary contribution. So there are many, many other things. Dr. Ahmed has published 8 books, numerous book chapters and encyclopedia articles, and has just recently completed a major 3-year study of the madrasa system of education in along the boundary between Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's been, for me, a personal pleasure indeed to have the last couple days with you, and I invite you to welcome Dr. Ahmed to the King's University College.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for giving me this opportunity to be here at a very fine institution. David introduced me to the origin and how great this institution is, and I consider it as my privilege to be here this morning. And thank you, Dr. Martin, for your invitation here. I will try to focus my remark, as I was asked to do, on India-Pakistan relations, particularly how the crisis has emerged after the recent attack in the city of Mumbai, previously known as Bombay. My tongue is not still familiar with Mumbai. Bombay, which was known mostly throughout the world for the Bollywood movies, Indian movies, hit the international headlines last November when there were 3 simultaneous terrorist acts, one in hospital, one in a hotel, and one at the train station. Ultimately, that resulted in the death of close to 160 people. Probably one of the largest terrorist acts in India in recent history. But unfortunately, this was not the only terrorist incident in India, and Bombay was not the only target. In India, all kinds of insurgencies are going on, particularly along the eastern states, what you call these 7 sisters of states on the eastern side of India, Assam, Nagaland, elsewhere. There are homegrown terrorist groups, and there are certain groups that infiltrate from outside, particularly from Pakistan. And when the Bombay incidents happened, it created a very tense situation between India and Pakistan. I was there in Islamabad during those days, and people were really scared that India is going to retaliate. And there were some very harsh and bellicose statements coming from the Indian officials, particularly from their interior minister, and some of the defense officials, threatening that they are going to target those training camps from where the terrorists came from. Following, of course, the great example of the United States, because it's the American government that set the precedent that you go in the hot pursuit of the terrorists wherever they are. Fortunately, this didn't happen, and the because of the intervention of the United States, Great Britain, and some of the other members of the international community who were concerned about the increasingly threatening situation in South Asia, emotions calmed down slowly, and thank God there is no imminent danger of another war between India and Pakistan. The Pakistanis didn't handle the crisis very well. That's for sure. Immediately after the bombings and all those terrorist activities in three different places in Bombay, the Pakistanis issued an immediate statement of condemnation and expressing their sympathy with the people of India and the government of India. But then immediately, Pakistanis denied any connection with it, at least at the official level. The Indians were quick to accuse Pakistan as a kind of programmed reaction, a very instinctive reaction. Anything that happens in India, immediately Pakistan is blamed, whether the Pakistanis are involved, actually or not. That's very instinctive. Immediate reaction. Blame the Pakistanis. Similarly, when something happens in Pakistan, a bomb in Lahore, a bomb in Karachi, the tendency is to blame the Indians. They did it. And both India and Pakistan have been playing this bomb for bomb match over the last 15 years. And there was a time, only about 6-7 years ago, where a bomb in Lahore will immediately be followed by a bomb in Delhi. Definitely. It was absolutely predictable kind of thing that the Indian intelligence people, RAW, research and whatever, research and analysis wing, that's the Indian intelligence agency, if they would create some trouble in Lahore, plant some bomb, the next day there will be a bomb in Delhi. The Pakistani ISI, Inter-Services Intelligence, will retaliate immediately. That was a pattern. And I think there was a kind of gentleman's agreement between the two thieves that we'll keep this level of tension, but we'll not let it go beyond that. There are certain red lines that both countries didn't want to cross. I think in the case of Bombay, I doubt that Pakistani government agencies were involved. But there is no doubt that the terrorists came from Pakistan and they belong to the militant organizations that at one time or another were sponsored, encouraged, supported, funded, and trained by the Pakistani intelligence agencies. So there is a connection from that. Obviously, during the Musharraf period, the Pakistani government abandoned the support. They withdrew the support, fearing that it is going to call for a retaliation from India, as well as a result of the pressure from the United States that Pakistan should rein in on its militant organizations. Otherwise, the consequences will be very serious. So, for the Indians, it was quite natural to say that the Pakistanis are involved. The Pakistanis were reluctant to accept any kind of responsibility, not even accepting that these people came from Pakistan. It took the Pakistani government probably a month and a half ultimately to admit, yes, at least one of the terrorists was from Pakistan. I was in Islamabad, and the very next day after the Bombay attack, everyone in Islamabad knew that these terrorists were from Pakistan, from southern Punjab. One Pakistan private television channel, they broadcast the name of the village from which the sole survivor of the terrorists belonged to. And then the television channel sent the reporting team to that village to interview his father. And his father said, yes, yes, he's my son. I recognized him when I saw his picture. The same evening, the chief of Pakistani intelligence, the Pakistani prime minister, the Pakistani minister of interior, they said, no, this village does not exist at all in Punjab. As if the GPS has not been so far invented. You can't go to Google search and the village is right there on your Google search. Exactly. Even the village does not exist there. But having said that, immediately the Pakistani intelligence people sent their operatives. They besieged the village, surrounded the village in order not to allow any of the journalists, Pakistani journalists, to go and talk to his relatives, his parents. So that was the kind of games the Pakistanis were playing. It took them almost 1.5 months to publicly acknowledge, yeah, he was from Pakistan, but he had nothing to do with the government agency. It was a private operation of this militant organization. And then, of course, they also had to admit that this militant organization was the one that we created it in the 1990s in order to fight against the Indians. So this is the immediate context. But let me go back to history in order to have some kind of a context in which we can understand what happened in Bombay and what's going to happen next. There are seemingly, in my view, two intractable conflicts in the world that have engaged the attention of the entire world for now almost for 60 years. And one conflict, we are familiar with the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the other is the India-Pakistan conflict. Both are of the same age. India and Pakistan became independent countries after the division of India in 1947, and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict started in 1948 when the State of Israel was created on the land that originally belonged to the Palestinian people. Both of these conflicts involved two religio-ethnic communities, Jews and Palestinians in one case, and Hindus and a large section of Muslim population of South Asia on the other. Both conflicts originated in the partition of an historic land, with one important difference, that in one case, a new state was created on a land that originally belonged to the native Palestinians. In the other case, historic India was divided into two independent states, that is, Pakistan and India. And then both of these conflicts resulted in the dislocation of hundreds and thousands of people. Millions of people became refugees when the State of Israel was established in the Middle East and when India was divided into two independent countries, Pakistan and India. But while millions of Muslims who left India to come to their new homeland in Pakistan, and millions of Hindus and Sikhs who had to leave the territories that became Pakistan and went to India, came to be largely, successfully absorbed, accommodated, settled in their new homelands, quite successfully. In the first case of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, unfortunately, we still have millions of Palestinian refugees spread all over the Arab world and still living in refugee camps, still living in a stateless condition, and still have no place to call their home and living in refugee camps. And then there is another common feature in these two historic conflicts, and I think David guessed it right. Let's blame the British. The British did it. And it's kind of what one can say that both conflicts were created by the vanishing colonial ingenuity of the British after World War II. Partitioning the historic Palestine and partitioning India. And as I'm speaking, it just occurred to me that both conflicts share another thing, which is their initials. Israel-Palestinian conflict, India-Pakistan conflict. That's another coincidence one can talk about. Anyway, to begin with, I would say there was some built-in, there was something structural and historical basis for the India-Pakistan conflict. And the fact that Pakistan was created in the face of a very strong opposition by the Indian National Congress, that became a source of permanent hostility. It was not the division between the Czech Republic and the Slovak Republic. You shake hands and say, well, we cannot live together, let's have two countries. Thank you very much, and let's have a farewell party tonight. We'll propose a toast of good luck to each other, and fine. No. The partition of India came about as a result of very intense struggle between the Pakistan Muslim League political party that represented the Muslims and the Indian National Congress that predominantly represented the Hindu community. Obviously, the Indian National Congress did not want their quote-unquote Bharat Mata, the Mother India, to be cut into half, and India to be partitioned. So Pakistan came into being as in the face of a very severe opposition. Hence, most of the Pakistanis still believe, or at least they have this perception, that their independent existence has never been accepted by the Indians and Indian leadership. 60 years after the independence of Pakistan, Pakistan is still considered by most Indian leaders as an artificial creation, as something that came into being, but hopefully it will wither away. Wither away in the sense that ultimately it will join India and will once more become one country. And this naturally creates a kind of mortal fear for many Pakistanis. And these fears are not unfounded, to say the least. In 1971 civil war between East Pakistan and West Pakistan, it was the Indian forces who attacked and who helped in the dismemberment of Pakistan. So the Pakistanis have a historical experience that India wants to disintegrate them, to dismember them, to finish them as a state. It's possible that some of these perceptions are unfounded. But my own experience in several conferences where I meet my Indian counterparts, very liberal, not necessarily belonging to the right-wing Hindu nationalist political parties, but very liberal, very secular Indian intellectuals. We meet in the conferences and talk about the relationship between India and Pakistan, and they begin their presentations with the assumption that there is something inherently wrong with the creation of Pakistan. And I tell them, well, if this is the basis on which you want to start a dialogue, then there cannot be any dialogue. If you deny my existence or the legitimacy of the state of Pakistan, raison d'etre of the Pakistani state, then of course we cannot talk. Because ultimately, if you say the creation of Pakistan was a historic mistake, fine, maybe it was a mistake. And it's possible that Muslims living together in the larger Indian community would have flourished better. They would have done much better. A united India probably would have been a much better choice. But let's admit, what has been done has been done. Pakistan cannot now be undone. You cannot unring the bell. And you cannot persuade the Pakistanis, okay, your forefathers made a mistake, why don't you rejoin India? No, that's not going to happen. But the core issue that has caused three full-scale wars between India and Pakistan. The first one in 1948, second in 1965, and a third in 1971, and then several small skirmishes and several border engagements that did have the potential of flaring up into a larger war. All of them are rooted in the issue of the Kashmir disputes. Kashmir, according to the Pakistanis, is a core issue between India and Pakistan. And they insist that until and unless the Kashmir dispute is not resolved, and until and unless the Indian government is not ready to address the core issue, there can be no peace between the two countries. Most of you probably are familiar about the origin of the Kashmir dispute. It was a princely state. It was not part of the regular part of British India. And when India was partitioned, the Indian Independence Act passed by the British Parliament said that the princely states are a separate category. The whole of India will be divided into two states, India and Pakistan. Muslim majority areas will go to Pakistan. Hindu majority areas will go to India. As far as the princely states are concerned, the rulers of these states, in consultation with their citizens, with their people, will decide whether they want to join India or Pakistan. And it also said that in making a decision, the rulers must also take into consideration their physical proximity either to Pakistan or to India. For most of the states, the choice was very easy. For Kashmir, it was a problem. The ruler of Kashmir was Hindu, and the overwhelming majority of his population was Muslim. The people wanted to join Pakistan, and the ruler initially didn't want to join either India or Pakistan. He had his own dreams, remaining independent country on his own, a sovereign state. The Pakistanis thought that it's quite natural that Kashmir should become a part of Kashmir because it is next to Pakistan. All the four rivers that feed Pakistani agriculture, they flow from Kashmir into Pakistan. The entire trade of Kashmir was with the Pakistani territory, with the province of Punjab. And then, of course, almost 90% of the people wanted to join Pakistan. There was a dispute, 1948, India and Pakistan fought the war. There was a stalemate. The Pakistanis were able to capture some small territory of the Kashmir state and the rest of the valley of the Kashmir, the prize of the prize, stayed with India. It was the Indian government that went to the United Nations with a complaint against Pakistan. The Pakistanis didn't go to the UN Security Council. The Indian government went. The Security Council passed a resolution which was accepted both by India and Pakistan. And the resolution was very simple. Ask the people. It's called plebiscite, referendum. The resolution said that there will be a referendum held under the auspices of the United Nations to determine the wishes of the people of Kashmir. If they want to join India, welcome. If they want to join Pakistan, again, fine. Both the Indian government and the Pakistani government agreed to these resolutions that were passed in 1949, then in 51, and last resolution was repeated in 1953. Unlike the resolution 242 that asked the Israelis to withdraw from the occupied territories that it captured in 67, the resolutions relating to Kashmir are still on the book and have not been implemented. India agreed to abide by these resolutions, but after 3-4 years, Prime Minister Nehru said, well, times have changed. The ground realities have changed. And moreover, we have held an election in the Kashmir part. And people have voted in the election, and the election is a substitute for international referendum. case closed. And they declared Kashmir as, quote-unquote, integral part of the Indian state. Of course, this has never been acceptable to the Pakistanis, who continue to claim that Kashmir belongs to them, or at least they are not saying it publicly that Kashmir belongs to us. Their principal position is that Kashmir belongs to the Kashmiri people, and whatever the Kashmiri people decide, we'll accept it. Then, of course, there was a Kargil crisis in 1999. In the Kargil crisis, it's very interesting, it was General Musharraf who planned and executed that operation on the India-Pakistan border, what we call the line of control. It's not an international border. The line that control that divides the Indian-controlled Kashmir with the Pakistani Kashmir is called the line of control. It's not an international border. President General Musharraf, who was not the president yet, he planned this operation to capture the Kargil area, kind of very strategic area for India, and then kind of come up with a fait accompli and with a position of strength, bargain with Indians. Surprisingly, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Mr. Nawaz Sharif, was not in the loop. He was very vaguely briefed by the journal, but he was not told the full story. And only a couple of months before the Kargil crisis started, when the Pakistanis initiated this trouble for the Indians on the Kargil sector, 2 months before that, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif had invited the Indian Prime Minister Vajpayee on a visit to Lahore. That was probably the friendliest visit by any Indian leader in the entire history of India and Pakistan. Vajpayee, who, remember, came from a right-wing, fundamentalist, Hindu nationalist political party. He comes to Lahore, makes wonderful speech, and he visits the monument where the Pakistan resolution was passed, in fact, giving a symbolic legitimacy and acceptance to the state of Pakistan. And then he declared, as far as India is concerned, Pakistan is going to stay. We forget and forgive what happened in the past. No one can undo Pakistan. Very friendly gesture. Nawaz Sharif was very serious in terms of developing relationship with India. Being a businessman and a capitalist, he saw a lot of opportunities in trade with India. That's why I think, what's his name? Most of the time he writes stupid columns in the New York Times. Sometimes.
Thomas Friedman.
Thomas Friedman, yeah. Thomas Friedman once wrote that the two countries that have McDonald's will never go to war with one another. So that was the time when both India and Pakistan were opening McDonald's and mutual trade, and Nawaz Sharif was of the same opinion as Tom Friedman, that since they will have established commercial business trade relations, so that will ultimately result in the political peace between the two countries. Anyway, after such a friendly visit, when both civilian governments were sending very peaceful signals to each other, Musharraf stabs the Indians in the back by executing the Kargil operation, and Vajpayee was very angry indeed. And he said, I'm quoting him, he said, that the Pakistanis have stabbed me in the back. He picks up the phone, he calls Nawaz Sharif and asks him, what's going on? Just a couple of months, we signed an agreement of composite dialogue and now this. And Nawaz Sharif said, what did happen? Because the Prime Minister, the civilian head of the state, a government, had no idea what had happened. The military was running its own business. Unfortunately, that was one major setback. 1999. But surprisingly, it was same Musharraf when he took over as the president of Pakistan in a military coup when Nawaz Sharif was overthrown, suddenly realized the importance of establishing friendly relationship with India. As if it was Begin, who kind of became convinced that let's have peace treaty with Egypt. Why? There could be several reasons. One, he realized Kargil was a big mistake. But secondly, I think that was a time in the late 90s, early 2000, the first time that the Pakistani military establishment and the Pakistani political elite realized how far India has gone in terms of its economic growth. India was becoming a global power in science, in technology, in industrial production, and was emerging as one of the most important economies in the world. And it was this realization, number one, we cannot compete with India in terms of our economic resources, in terms of our conventional forces. But if we establish friendly relationship with India and solve some of our problems that we carry from the last 40 years, 50 years, we can participate in the economic prosperity of India by establishing relationship of trade and commerce. Musharraf probably was the most forthcoming in terms of providing fresh and innovative ideas of how to solve the Kashmir dispute. He goes to India, it's known in Agra Summit in 2005, 2006, exactly I don't remember, and he presents for the first time a range of choices to the Indians on the issue of Kashmir. Before that, Pakistan never flinched even an inch from their principled position, which was that the only solution to the Kashmir dispute is the implementation of the UN Security Council resolutions. Hold a referendum, ask the people of Kashmir, whatever they decide will be acceptable. That was the first time in 2005 that Musharraf puts on the table a range of options. One option was plebiscite, internationally monitored referendum, which he knew that India would never accept. Secondly, Kashmir naturally consists of three regions. The valley is predominantly Muslim, Jammu area is predominantly Hindu, and Ladakh area is predominantly Buddhist. One idea of Musharraf was that divide Kashmir into three regions and make them autonomous regions. Third option, internationalization or some kind of international control. Fourth option, open the entire Kashmir to both countries as a neutral, autonomous region where both India and Pakistan have some say. Fifth option, divide Kashmir on the existing line of control, which the Indians probably would have loved to do, with minor adjustments, of course. And these options were so attractive that the Indians probably did not expect these things to come from Pakistan. They have been dreaming about them for years to settle the dispute of Kashmir without giving their sovereignty to anybody else, particularly the Pakistanis, on the state of Kashmir. Bajpayee was convinced that these are very good options and we can talk about it. An agreement was drafted and it was supposed to be signed. Some minor adjustments about what they call crossing the T's and dotting the I's, what left. And while they were doing it, the Central Executive Committee of Prime Minister Bajpayee, what's the party's name? BJP, Bharatiya Janata Party. They had a session in Delhi and they sent a message to the Prime Minister. No. No talks, no argument. The leader, who was the second most important leader of BJP, Mr. K.L. Advani, a very fanatic right-wing nationalist leader, who was also responsible for the destruction of the Babri Masjid a few years ago, earlier. He put his foot down and he said, there is going to be a revolt in the party if we sign any peace agreement with Pakistan. Musharraf had to leave, taking the next flight back home, and that was a disaster. Later on, many of the Indian analysts, who are not necessarily friendly to Pakistan, they lamented that it was the last chance India had to solve this problem, and we missed the opportunity. So, many of the people I meet here in the West, in the United States, and I mean, once in Minnesota, somebody asked me, why can't I, of these Hindus and Muslims, be good Christians? I mean, I'm sorry, you are not good Christians in that sense. And the whole idea is what James Joyce once said about the Irish conflict, the two bloody fools fighting for bloody nothing. No, that's not the case. It's not that two bloody fools are fighting for bloody nothing. Kashmir is a great prize, as far as both India and Pakistan are concerned. Kashmir for India is a symbol of the integrity of its secular ideology. It's very important. If India cedes Kashmir to Pakistan, on the basis in response to the Pakistani claim that we want Kashmir because Kashmir is our Muslims, that negates the Indian secularist ideology, that forces the Indians to accept the fact that Muslims cannot live in India. And that is absolutely unacceptable to India. On the other hand, Kashmir defines the Delhi-Bajor Act for the Pakistanis. Because if India was divided on the basis of religion, that the Muslim area should constitute Pakistan, then Kashmir should come to Pakistan. And then the geographical proximity, and then the fact that the entire structure of Pakistani agriculture in Punjab depends on the waters flowing from Kashmir. That is controlled by India. And we have seen in recent, for the last 2 years, the Pakistanis have been complaining to everyone who is willing to listen to them that the Indians have stopped supplying water to their rivers and their agricultural crop is suffering. During the Kennedy administration, the World Bank intervened and the Americans and the British helped. Both India and Pakistan signed the Water Distribution Treaty. It's called Indus Basin Treaty. And that worked very well for quite some time. But for the last about 5-6 years, the Indians have started reneging on the treaty. They have started building several dams on the rivers upstream, which means no water for Pakistan. So these are so many kind of complicated issues that need to be addressed. So the Pakistani position is very clear in their own perception. Indian position on Kashmir is very clear in their own perception. But nobody asks, what do the Kashmiris want? And hence you have seen in recent years, particularly during the past 20 years, the emergence of a movement for the independence of Kashmir. Overwhelming majority of the Kashmiri people on both sides of the border, the Pakistani side, more so in the Indian side, are saying we are fed up both with India and Pakistan. We want to remain independent. But having failed to capture Kashmir, win Kashmir by force, the Pakistani military establishment decided to another strategy, and to take advantage of the discontentment and dissatisfaction and frustration and alienation of the people in the Indian Kashmir. And they came up with the idea of fighting a proxy war against India in Kashmir through funding, supporting, and training militant groups and sending them to fight against the Indians inside Indian Kashmir. What you see in the newspaper, jihadi organizations. Of course, as I said, there are homegrown separatist groups in India everywhere, particularly in Kashmir. In the Indian Kashmir, you do have homegrown separatist groups fighting for their independence. But one must not minimize the role of the Pakistani ISI, in Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, in encouraging and funding and supporting the insurgency in the Indian Kashmir, particularly since the early 1990s. For almost 10 years, the Pakistanis were able, through the use of these proxies, to engage 500,000 of Indian troops in the Indian Kashmir. At one point, the number of troops that India had to deploy in the Kashmir area was 600,000. And with an expense account of only a few hundred thousand dollars on the part of the Pakistanis. This was probably the cheapest war ever fought by any country. You don't send your soldiers, your troops, they are fine, they are not dying. You send the volunteers, jihadis, using the name of Islam. Well, I'm going to liberate a fellow Muslim. So you motivate them in the name of jihad, in the name of Islam, go and die, give them a few dollars, give them the weapons. And you cost India the deployment of 500,000 troops. Imagine how much it must have cost India on a daily basis. And this has been happening for the last 12, 13, 14 years. I must also mention the third milestone in the history of India-Pakistan relationship. That was 1974, when India exploded its nuclear device. Now, like most other things, the Pakistanis had to respond. None. Indian bomb had to be matched by a Pakistani bomb. Prime Minister Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto, who was the Prime Minister at Pakistan at that time, he made a remark in one of the newspaper interviews. He said, look, the Christians have the bomb, the Jews have the bomb, the atheist Russians, Chinese, they have the bombs. Now the Hindus have the bombs. Why not Muslims? So that's why the BBC, when it produced a program, it called the Pakistani nuclear program as Islamic bomb. Of course, it has nothing to do with Islam. Pakistan was essentially responding to the existential threat that it felt to its very existence. India had already dismembered Pakistan in 1971, and now in 1974, India explodes a nuclear device. The Pakistani entire military establishment lost their sleep for months and months. They became really scared. And then Bhutto said, my nation will eat grass but will make a bomb. In 1998, May, when India exploded 5 of its nuclear devices, within 2 weeks the Pakistanis responded by exploding 6 nuclear devices of their own, one up. Now, come to think of it, there are many people, and that includes myself, I'm against nuclear proliferation. I don't like countries making bombs. But Pakistan was not the one that introduced nuclear weapons in South Asia. It was India. Pakistanis were only responding. There is nothing good about nuclear weapons. Everything is bad. But then, come to think of it, since the introduction of the nuclear weapons between India and Pakistan, the Pakistan has neutralized the Indian superiority in conventional weapons. Because now there is a complete parity in strategic weapons. In fact, according to most analysts, Pakistan's nuclear capacity is little higher and much superior than the Indians. Secondly, Pakistan's delivery system is much better. What does that mean? I'm not bragging and saying, kind of bellicose, oh, really, Pakistan is a good bomb. No. The moral of the story is that this whole idea of the mutually assured destruction has diminished the possibility and prospects for larger conventional conflicts between India and Pakistan. Because any skirmishes that happen on India-Pakistan border will be immediately monitored and watched by the military establishments of both countries. And they will be, both of them will make sure that they do not escalate to a point that the nuclear war begins. So that has, in my view, almost eliminated the possibility of a war between India and Pakistan. If the war had taken place, it would have taken place in 2001 December, when Indian Parliament was attacked, and India amassed 1 million troops of its own on the Pakistani borders. But only to intimidate the Pakistanis. The Indians knew that once you make a, what you call the armored thrust into Pakistan, and once the Pakistani realize that they are going to be defeated in conventional war, they will not hesitate to use tactical nuclear weapons. Similarly, whenever the Indians feel similar existential threat, so that is a kind of standard scenario that, in my view, ultimately will be a guarantee for peace. However, recently I heard that even after the Mumbai attack, the two governments have agreed to begin what they call the composite dialogue, and we should hope that something will come of it.
I am very thankful to you for listening, and I am sorry I took more time than I should have done. Thank you very much.